We welcome in our friend, the talented writer Colin Fleming, to talk with us about autumnal pop art. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
You ready for penetration, Kimball?
Say
that. I looked it up.
I'm always anticipating the moment that you penetrate my mind and my soul with your depth of knowledge.
Can I make an observation?
Please.
So I walk around a lot, right? This irks me. And I notice in my many miles of traveling various street names that are coming up over and over again. For instance, I see Pleasant Street quite often. Now, I could say to you, I find sunflowers pleasant. You know what I never see, Kimball? Pleasure Street. But I could say that sunflowers give me pleasure. It's benign. Why in this world is there not a Pleasure Street? Shouldn't there be a Pleasure Street? It's like discrimination. Pleasant Street everywhere you go. Multiple ones in the same town, it seems.
I believe that's the last stop for a streetcar named Desire, is right on Pleasure Street.
Ah, Kimball!
I may be wrong.
You're what this saucy neighbor across the street from me when I was a kid would have called a hot pistol.
I try to be on occasion, although the ammunition's running a little low. But we want to talk about some great autumnal art. Now, what's your qualifier for autumnal pop art?
I have to think up something every week to come on the show, man. So I just monkey some stuff together. And
no, were they released in the fall? Do they have a fall theme or a subtext? Or do you just enjoy watching them or listening to them in the fall?
Well, there was so much to choose from. We could have gone, and maybe we will later, the poem route of Shelley and Keats and John Clare, and certainly could do things with the classical music and jazz, too, although I guess jazz sort of straddles that divide between maybe not as overt populism and actual populism. But what I wanted to do was look at some pop culture work, touchstones of pop culture, at least in their own time, that had that fall vibe to them. And it's not so much that they're released in fall, although some of these will be. It's more just that they capture autumn either on the screen, as it were, in a couple cases that we'll discuss, or in somehow in the music, embodied in the music. Maybe it can be a weariness, for instance, or it can be, in terms of the films, the mise-en-scene, that saturated color. There are films that take place in fall. There are films that when you see them in May, you say, I wish it were fall. And there again, those pop culture touchstones.
All right, well, let's begin with a slice of horror from 1958, Horror of Dracula, which really kicked off the preeminence of the Hammer Studios in making these great horror films.
It's the second Hammer film after Frankenstein. So what had happened is we in the States had this cycle of horror films courtesy of Universal. So when you think of Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff and the 1931 Dracula and Bride of Frankenstein in 1935, the sequel to the original Frankenstein and The Mummy and all of that stuff, that's Universal. And somebody in England at Hammer Studios had the idea to, hey, we can do adaptations of these pictures, which are usually based on, right, British source material in terms of the novels and Mary Shelley and Bram Stoker, and we will put them in color because that hasn't been done, and it'll be exciting. And we can sort of really push the limits of what we're allowed to, we think, get away with. And so really the bell cow for the franchise early on was going to be, it was just titled Dracula in England, and it became Horror of Dracula here to distinguish it from that Bela Lugosi film, is the Peter Cushing, he's the vampire hunter, and Christopher Lee as Dracula himself. And there is no film, or there hadn't been a film at the time, that looked at all like this film. And it was realistic in some ways with the color. But at the same time, the color and what certain things like blood, for instance, does not look, it look like human blood. But that made it more exciting. The blood almost looks like impasto on the Van Gogh painting that is just never, ever going to dry. And it was an interesting adaptation because Christopher Lee tried to imbue the Dracula character with a degree of sympathy, like this Macbethian sympathy, because he read the original Bram Stoker novel and he thought, man, this guy doesn't really want to be doing this thing that he has to do, and I'm going to make him somewhat sympathetic. So he's not a chatty Dracula, but compared to what Christopher Lee will become in the sequels, he talks. Later, he doesn't really talk. He broods and he bites.
From there to one of my all-time favorite movies, I love Hitchcock, but we don't often see, or we don't see enough of his humor. And 1955's The Trouble with Harry, a very funny movie, beautifully shot. And if I didn't already live in New England, it would make me want to move there, particularly in the fall, just as long as there are no Harrys to trip over.
Yes, it's about a man who dies in the woods, and various people think, damn, my bad, I might have done that. And it's just replete with red herrings. And actually, you could think of it this way. I think that the Newhart show was inspired by this film, because it's that kind of wackiness where anything goes. And there's an early episode of Newhart, I think it's the second episode of the first season, where there is a body buried at the Stratford.
Right.
In the basement. And that's when we meet the three woodsmen, which I think their build is that in the script. And you could see these characters in this anything-goes world of Hitchcock, where it's actually kind of like Newhart meets Weekend at Bernie's. And what's funny about it, too, is they know these people that's like kind of an older couple, or they're going to become a couple, and two people younger that are going to become a younger couple. The way they sort of circumvent the law is they're like, just bury him again. They just keep reburying his body. And it's like, it really, I guess if you were a politically correct mortician right now, it would horrify you. Like you'd take to Twitter and you'd be like, cancel Hitchcock. Because there's not a lot of respect for this cadaver, I would say. And also, no one seems to give a rat's ass about the dead guy. I mean, that's where a lot of the humor is. It's that inappropriate gallows. I'm not just whistling past the graveyard. I have a ragtime band trailing behind me, and we're rocking out. It's just, and Hitchcock, he didn't go to that place. We talked about before how his British pictures could be funny, but this was like, what are you doing, man? And the reviews were mixed because critics, they didn't know what to make of it. It was so black in some ways, but it was so witty.
And you have to have the right kind of person to be a leading man, I think, in any Hitchcock films. And John Forsythe is just terrific in this.
You do. You certainly do. And sometimes, like Hitchcock, he would get the wrong leading man, or he would get the right leading man and then complain about him afterwards. Like he complained about Jimmy Stewart and Vertigo after the fact. He's like, oh, he's too old. Well, I mean, you cast him. It was like your decision. So this is true. You have that leading man, but it's very much an ensemble piece. You had Edmund, you have Santa there from Miracle on 34th Street,
right?
Edmund Gunn. And it's the scenery, the Vermont setting. I mean, it's just, you don't expect, like, there's that Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce Sherlock Holmes picture where they're in Canada, Scarlet Claw, which we've talked about. And you don't expect to see those two in Canada. You don't expect to see Hitchcock and co in Vermont, right? Like it's not really a Hitchcock type of setting. I mean, he could be out in the woods. Certainly he's going to be out in the woods with Cary Grant, and then there's Mount Rushmore and all that stuff. But the Vermont woods, and for me personally, and it's set in fall, and it looks like fall. It's like everything you want visually for an autumnal picture. And that was a reason I was always partial to this movie, because I don't know what's really better than like New England fall. And I think a lot of people in New England, I mean, I'm going to be biased, but a lot of people are going to say Vermont is the place out of our six states, if you count Connecticut.
Hey, wait, I was born in Connecticut. Also in this film, the Beaver, Jerry Mathers, makes an appearance, and it was the screen debut of Shirley MacLaine.
I was thinking about the Beaver in this film because you have this filmography and you have this career, and this is like your artistic high point, right? Like,
yes.
It just shows you how luck and chance and whatever, not that he's not fine in the film or whatever, but like the one thing he did in his life, really, that like you can say that's going to be around. I mean, there are some episodes of Leave It to Beaver that have aged really well, don't you think? It's one of those shows that certain episodes of the Andy Griffith Show, just the Golden Girls we've talked about, but Leave It to Beaver is an even older show. It's just aged well. But this is really his main thing, is encountering this body, the Beaver. I mean, right? That's like the back of your baseball card. That's your, like, amazing. That's the year that you led the league in triple.
Right.
So,
right. Well,
yeah,
said. Yes,
I always wondered what he made of that when he looked. Shirley MacLaine obviously did lots of other things, but like when Jerry Mathers looked back on that, like, did he think like, huh, that was my kind of like one sort of go for glory artistic moment?
Yeah. Instead, I'm doing Still the Beaver Part 3.
Yeah, I mean, I love Leave It to Beaver. Not in two. I think that whole sibling relationship is so real, and so, and we've talked about Eddie Haskell before and all of that. I mean, not to downplay the quality of the show, but yeah, this was sort of his artistic in the sun moment.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Well, let's move to the world of music and the band's second album, just called The Band, although some refer to it as the Brown Album.
Brown's a pretty autumnal color.
Yes.
I would say.
Oh, yes.
Not like, you know, sometimes we think about it like brown and not sexy, kind of like blah, but I mean, even the color of this particular brown looks like sort of that like rich autumn earth of the season. So it's always, I mean, but the band in general, they always sound autumnal, don't they? They don't. They're
they
not
do.
Like, hey, it's June. They always have this sagacity, you can read a lot in a person's eyes, I think. And certain people, rare people, have like wise eyes, or you might call them old eyes. Even if they're not old, they contain this world beyond our world. I feel like that's a fall characteristic, and I feel like the band were, in some ways, the most fall-based musical unit. And, I mean, you have it in the songs, too, like
right.
King Harvest, right? I mean, Harvest is, we have Thanksgiving now, but, like, it was originally all these harvest festivals, which I would have liked a lot more, because you're like, ooh, I'll eat these things from the sea, and I'll have this corn, and thank you, Earth, and thank you for not being so hot anymore. It's getting really comfortable out. So it's like this harvest festival of an album, and it's bittersweet. It's tinged with a kind of sadness, but it's not like that death quality of winter. I mean, you have Up on Cripple Creek. It's a pretty playful song, but it's a late September song, not right. My goodness, it's 100 degrees in July song.
Well, and you've also got The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down.
Right, and talk about like the whole idea of something coming to an end. And it's interesting that you have these Canadians singing this song of, I wonder if people would try to politicize this right now, because it's a Civil War song.
I've heard they have. I saw something just recently, and I actually thought of you, because people were saying, do we need to hear that song anymore? Yes. Yes, I believe we do. It's a great song, and it's not a song set in the present day, okay? It's a story song. Get over yourselves.
Oh, it's like when we discussed Buster Keaton's The General. I mean, he's the most likable, lovable, winsome guy in all of American cinema, right? That character. He is a soldier for the South. Many people who were soldiers for the South were people who were no better or worse than anybody else. That's just the reality of human nature. And many people who went to war for the North had slaves and their family previously. And there was nobody who was going to say, you know what, this isn't, I'm going to do something separate. I'm going to buck the sociological trend. It's like nobody does that. So this was a piece of song-based fiction. And I like how you put that, because it really is a kind of, well, it's a eulogy, but it's a eulogy in this sonic short story form. And it is a lament. It's a tremendously sad song, but it's not like sad in the kind of, oh, wow, I'm depressed now. It's a pay your respect song to people who had died and homes that had been torn, all sorts of things like that. It wasn't, hooray, we used to love slaves, and boo, we don't have them anymore. It's nothing like that at all. In fact, you could imagine blue and gray soldiers singing something like this together, even when it was all over.
Absolutely. And finally, we move to one of my favorite Beatles albums, Beatles for Sale, which is such, well, it's such a remarkable turn from the guys who'd been cheery and happy and She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand, to this album that it's got some great covers, but the original songs, this might be the darkest collection of Beatles originals on any one album.
That's an interesting theory. I would say that the second side of A Hard Day's Night, when you think they're at the height of their ebullience, is pretty dark, at least for them. This is pretty tired. This is 3 a.m, and I have another 1,000 words to write, and I'll chug some coffee and keep at it. And if you're good, your talent is still going to come through in that situation. So that's what the Beatles were doing. And this would have been seen, if you were someone who was a critical thinker at the time, not that there were a lot of them concerning the Beatles, there was a lot of like, woohoo, going on. It would have been seen as a major backslide, because you just had this album of entirely Lennon McCartney songs. So you didn't just have an album entirely of originals, which you had throughout their career, of course, later on, but it's the only all Lennon McCartney album in A Hard Day's Night. And songwriting-wise, that was a peak. That was like the kind of thing that Dylan had to notice. Now they're relying again on the, it's almost an even split of the covers. And the covers are not some of their higher regarded covers. I think that they get underrated. I think Rock and Roll Music, the Chuck Berry number, is one of Lennon's best vocals. I mean, he has to sing it passionately, but also as though he is a metronome. He has to fit in a lot of words in a short amount of space, and he has to come to like a full Alexander Ovechkin power stop, right? And then go back off in the other direction, you know, like you know exactly what I'm talking about when I say them. So they sound like they have that weariness of fall in their sound. And so they were doing these BBC sessions. They did a couple of them, and the host, he says he makes the mistake of saying this to Lennon. He's like, because the single I Feel Fine and She Loves You, She's a Woman, we're out at the same time. And he said, I remember like the B side over the A side, meaning the McCartney number. She's a Woman. And like, and Lennon's like offended by this, because the other song is like, you can tell. And the guy is questioning them about what's changed in life with fame and you can't ride a bus. I've always thought this was interesting. And McCartney says, I like riding a bus. It got me thinking about the role of a bus in the Beatles' career. Just that sort of day in, day out activity. They auditioned George Harrison riding on a bus.
That's right.
And that's interesting, because other people have downtime, and it just speaks to me that the Beatles never really had downtime. They put that time to use creatively, and I wonder if they weren't like that, and they weren't auditioning George Harrison on a bus, and Paul McCartney wasn't saying that he misses riding on a bus. Do you get that middle section in A Day in the Life where the guy's on a bus? Like, it's just something as simple as a bus, but it comes up over and over and over again in this band's history at like these crucial sort of throwaway moments that no one notices. It just struck me as like very the human side of art making.
And the songs, the original songs on this album, are so introspective for young guys, whether it's Lennon's I'm a Loser, No Reply, or one of my favorite McCartney songs, I'll Follow the Sun.
I'll Follow the Sun was one that it doesn't sound like a bright summer sun either, does it?
No, that is a sun going down at about 4:45 in late October sun.
Yeah, it'd be great to get where I'm going before it's dark type of sun. And he had that song early on from going back to 1960 when he was recording with Lennon in the bathroom at his family home. But certainly Lennon's their music publisher had remarked regarding No Reply. It's like this you're getting better. This is the first one that has like a natural an arc. It has a beginning, it has a middle and an end. And he meant arc, like not with the chords or anything. It's like you've told the story. And if you think about it, it does resolve. You get like this it's not even a vignette. It's more rounded than a vignette. And then I'm a Loser with that sort of deadpan Dylan delivery that you don't see anywhere else. And his voice had changed. So that certainly, probably because of all the pot, that had been a factor on this album. So you actually had Lennon singing in a different way than he had before, simply because his vocal quality had altered. He wasn't a worse singer, but he doesn't sound the same as he does on I Should Have Known Better. Like that voice is gone. This is more adenoidal. It's what you're going to get on Help and Rubber Soul and even on Strawberry Fields Forever. So like Strawberry Fields Forever, that sort of gets its gestation period, I would say, in these reflective moments. But we don't ever knit up 1964 and fall 1966, which was when Lennon was really working on Strawberry Fields.
No, also, too, it's interesting that they celebrate their love of rockabilly with a couple of Carl Perkins covers, and then their own attempt at it, which worked very well, later would become a number one country song for Roseanne Cash, I Don't Want to Spoil the Party.
Oh, that's just one of the most underrated Beatles songs, don't you think?
I do.
That is a song that is never talked about. Harmonically, it's rich. There really isn't anything like that during this time period, maybe in their catalog. And it's proto Rubber Soul. I'm looking through you with more melody, I would say. And it's in this minor key. It's such a great song tucked away that you would never see. And then you have another song tucked away during the sessions, the cover of, which would have been a great fit, but also not a great fit, the cover of Little Willie John's Leave My Kitten Alone. And I feel like they almost left that off because it didn't, as they say nowadays, vibe with the rest of everything on that. Like it would have awoken things too much. Not that it's a sleepy album, but it's like that October, as you said, sun going down, Beatledom, on Beatledom album. And really it's their fall album. And look at the album cover, right? I mean, again, how can you not think autumn when you see the Beatles in Hyde Park? It's a Robert Freeman cover, too, and you see the actually changed color of the leaves on the ground, and it's like, what time are we going trick-or-treating, fellas?
There you go. Four great examples of autumnal art from Colin Fleming to us this afternoon. Colin, thank you as always. Have a good week, and we'll check in again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.
ColinFlemingLit.com. Obviously, you need to subscribe if you're not already to the Many Moments More blog.